I began the season by asserting that this election cannot be separated from the Me Too movement. That more than anything, it was a reckoning with male power, with how we've accepted that power as a given. A record number of women are now headed to Congress, with remarkable diversity. And as we inevitably look forward to the next election, to 2020, several of those women are top of mind.
I want to thank New York for giving me the honor and privilege to keep fighting for you in the U.S. Senate. Elections are always about who you fight for. And I promise you, I will fight for your families as hard as I fight for my own.
That certainly includes the junior senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, who won by a whopping 30-point margin. She's on pretty much every list of top contenders for the Democratic nomination in 2020. And over the past couple of years, she's particularly drawn attention for her unapologetic challenge to men who abuse their power, including Democrats. She said Bill Clinton should have resigned after his affair with Monica Lewinsky. And she took a lot of flack for saying Al Franken had to go too.
Al Franken is a friend of mine. He did great work in the Judiciary Committee, so it was really hard and really heartbreaking.
In a conversation on The View, she was challenged about being too aggressive on the matter, and she did not back down.
He's entitled to a hearing. He is, but he's not entitled to my silence, Joy. And no. When you
if she runs for president, this posture, this demand for accountability will be a huge part of the 2020 elections. But who is Kirsten Gillibrand? How'd she go pretty quickly from relative obscurity to being one of the Democratic Party's marquee names? I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. And in this episode, we look ahead to 2020. And we ask what Senator Gillibrand's rise tells us about the relationship between gender and power in American politics. I'm here with WNYC's politics reporter, Bridget Bergen, who has been talking to the senator. Hey, Bridget.
Hey, Kai.
So, Bridget, what will become obvious here in a minute is that you took a few weeks off to have a baby, which was one of the first things that you and Kirsten Gillibrand talked about.
Oh, yeah. It's the first thing she asked me about the last time we talked. Hi, Senator Gillibrand. How are you?
Congratulations on your little girl. What's her name?
It is Patricia Jane Bergen Hart, and we call her PJ.
PJ! Amazing.
So, Bridget, it's been a big year for both of you. And what I'm curious about and what I'm really trying to get my head around is, you know, this woman who is a mom of two herself, how she thinks about power.
Well, in my conversations with her, I get the sense that in the almost 10 years she's been sitting in the Senate chamber, in Hamilton speak, she sees herself as a mother and a woman who's in the room where it happens, and she wants to drive conversations that are important to her and to women and families all over the country.
So she's been elected to the Senate for a second time now, and before that she served in Congress from a rural upstate district. But remind us of how she carved out this path to power. I mean, she moved in a relatively short time from obscurity, as I said earlier, to this national spotlight.
Yeah, but first, I gotta talk about a man. A guy with an interesting relationship to power himself. David Paterson.
Yes, the former New York governor. He was our first black governor. He came to office after Eliot Spitzer resigned in disgrace over his prostitution scandal.
Uh-huh. He was called the accidental governor. But, you know, in Paterson's brief tenure, he may well have changed the history of American politics. Let me take it back to December 2008, when he wasn't well known beyond New York. That's when a lot of the country meets him for the first time as the punchline of a bit on Saturday Night Live.
Here to publicly address the issue is New York Governor David Paterson.
The Paterson impersonator rolls up to Seth Meyers on the Weekend Update news desk.
Thank you. So, Seth.
It starts with jokes about Paterson's marital infidelity and teenage drug use.
True, but my crimes were merely crimes of the heart and drug crimes.
But then they really go there, okay. Poking fun at something the governor has no control over.
It's bad out there, Seth. I mean, if you don't believe me, take a look at this graph that I got here. Now,
Paterson is legally blind.
This shows that unemployment in 2008
Governor, it's upside down.
You bet it is. The whole world is upside down, and someone's got to fix it.
I mean, I can take a joke, and I make jokes about myself.
That's the real David Patterson, when I called him earlier this year. A decade later, that bit still really annoys him.
But sort of Mr. Magoo character playing David Patterson.
Yeah.
It was pretty harsh.
It was. But Kai, I'm telling you all of this because of what happened the next day. Mm. Remember, it's December 2008. Barack Obama has just been elected president after a bitter primary fight with Hillary Clinton, who's then senator from New York. Right. Famously, Obama tries to heal the Democratic Party's wounds by tapping Clinton for Secretary of State. And that leaves a vacant Senate seat in New York. It falls to David Patterson, the accidental governor, to fill it.
Right. And he's got to oversee this really important transfer of power, which is just a rare opportunity.
Yeah. So the next day, Patterson meets with none other than Kirsten Gillibrand about it.
In the middle of the interview, one of my staff members just comes in to alert me that they want to put out this press release, which was sort of laughing along with Saturday Night Live, which I thought was insulting.
He's not cool with this idea and basically tells me he scolded the staffer out of the office.
Well, he sort of tried to go back to the conversation, and maybe about 2 or 3 minutes later,
I just remember saying, I'm really sorry about that. That was really terrible and mean, and I think we should do something about it.
Now, Senator Gillibrand said to me, you know something, Governor, this is none of my business. I was just sitting here. But I want to tell you, you should stand up for the disabled. You shouldn't just go on the show and laugh along with them.
I wanted to say something because I didn't know if anybody else had bothered. And, you know, it's not great to be mimicked and disregarded and devalued on some level. And I think for women, you know, we face that a lot all the time. I think communities of color face it all the time. And I think for our governor to have endured that was wrong. And I wanted him to know that I felt that.
Interesting. And so she understood that he felt it was wrong, too.
Exactly. In what's become something of a hallmark of her leadership style, she read the moment right. Others may have missed this cue, assumed a, you know, more tough guy approach, but her empathy made a real impression on Patterson.
Right.
You know, I can't say that that was the reason that I chose her, but, you know, we're all human beings and we are touched by things that people do around us.
Now, that didn't immediately make Gillibrand a shoo-in. Patterson set up this whole evaluation process, and he was getting a lot of pressure to pick a big name. He says some people even encouraged him to appoint himself. He told me under his own system, Gillibrand wasn't actually his number one.
Grading out the candidates, mm-hmm. The candidate who I thought was the best candidate at that time was Andrew Cuomo.
Who is, of course, now the New York governor and yet another name that we're talking about for 2020.
Right. But Patterson says he was also concerned about choosing a woman.
At that period of time, there were a lot of women who felt that in the Democratic primary of 2008, that the old boys network defeated racism. That, in other words, the bias against Senator Barack Obama was not as great as the bias against Hillary Clinton. And many women around New York, activist women, felt that way. And I could kind of understand why they did.
Which takes us to a stage in Albany in January 2009, where Patterson names who he described to me as his equally qualified second choice.
She is perceptive, she's courageous, she is outspoken. I am appointing her to the United States Senate representing New York today. Please welcome our next senator and current Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand.
It will be my honor and most humble duty to serve each and every one of you.
And just to give you a sense of how high stakes this decision was, President Obama called to congratulate her.
In the middle of a live press conference.
Yeah, while she's on camera, and Gillibrand, our visibly Senator flustered, invited, just kept and, speaking.
Sorry.
That was what I was... I hope someone else talked to him in the interim. They said he's going to call back. Please call back.
The newly minted senator does get a call back from the president moments later. And Patterson makes clear that he does have a sense of humor, as long as he's the one making the jokes.
Right. Now, fast forward 10 years. We know that after the Obama election, the Democratic Old Boys Network did not, of course, defeat racism. But still, Patterson was essentially taking a stand against that old boys club in favor of empowering a woman, which was a prescient decision given that Gillibrand is now making the top list for presidential candidates. And there's something even more poetic in that, because probably her greatest political teacher was a woman who had an early influence on Gillibrand. Up next, we have that story. So, Bridget, we were talking about Gillibrand's mentor. Tell us more.
Oh, yeah. She talks about it often. Here she is back in 09 at her Senate appointment.
I grew up right here in Albany, and my role model in politics was my grandmother. And I don't know how many of you knew Polly Noonan, but...
You hear all that applause, Kai? That's because in that world of Democratic politics, Polly Noonan was a big deal. For decades.
She was a woman who never went to college, and she was a secretary.
She started as a secretary, working for the state legislature in the 1930s, but she amassed real power with the Albany County Democratic machine. In part, it was her connections. She was a close confidant of Albany's mayor of four decades, but she was a force of nature in her own right. A gatekeeper to patronage jobs, a coveted endorsement. She would get the whole family involved come election season. That all made an early impression. It changed Gillibrand.
Just through her actions, she told me that it was important, that politics was important, that public service was important, that being involved in government was important. And not every kid has that message, and not every kid has that from a female messenger.
Noonan was also a complete and total character.
And wait, isn't this the play? Isn't there an off-Broadway play inspired by her that's, like, getting all these rave reviews?
Oh, yeah. And there are many crazy stories. Like this one time in the late 1970s, Noonan is working the greeter table at a dinner for the Albany Democratic Women's Group. She was their president until the day she died. You would get a stamp when you went in to show you paid. It said, vote Democrat.
Of course.
So Noonan hugs this guy named Ron Canestrieri, who was then the mayor of this small city of Cohoes and later a state senator. And then, well, I caught up with him by phone, so I'll let him tell it.
And then she said, oh, Polly, how are you? I was talking to her. I said, yeah, I'm fine. I lifted up her dress. And there was a stamp on her underwear. She was a force.
Noonan flashed him. He's mortified, and she thinks it's hilarious. It made such an impression on him, he shared the story with the Albany Times Union after she died in 2003, just shy of her 88th birthday.
Which is great. That's actually really savvy.
Yeah, I mean, think about how bold, how confident she must have felt in her position, in her power. Even though she never ran for office herself, she knew how the game was played, and she knew how to influence the outcome by keeping people off balance.
Right.
Gillibrand, born in 1966, is learning at the feet of a political master long before she ever knows she wants to be in politics herself. In her audiobook, Off the Sidelines, she sums it up like this.
My grandmother Polly had taught me that in politics, you do what's needed. If a candidate you support needs an envelope stuffed, you stuff an envelope. If that candidate needs a breakfast hosted, you host a breakfast. When you believe in a cause, you aren't picky. You just help.
So when did she decide to move into politics then? Because she started off as a corporate lawyer, right?
Oh, yeah. She was deep in the belly of the beast, representing big tobacco against the government, in fact. And she was not feeling it. So she's applying for public sector jobs, fundraising for candidates, but nothing is clicking. She can't break into politics with an actual job.
Yeah, I was frustrated. I was really frustrated because I was at my law firm working endless hours. I just felt like I was pushing paper for big companies who just cared about money. And I didn't feel like I was changing the world, and I didn't feel like I was making a difference.
So she goes to hear a speech from then Housing Secretary Andrew Cuomo. And he's talking about the importance of being involved, of being a Democrat. Something in Gillibrand just snaps.
I've been trying and I can't find my way from A to B. And so I kind of stormed up to him afterwards and said, well, Mr. Secretary, I think it's an insider's game. And he, being provocative, said, well, would you move to Washington?
Now, just to put this interaction in sharp relief, here's a guy who also grew up in politics, whose father was the former governor of New York and knew Gillibrand's grandmother, Polly Noonan, very well. And so when Gillibrand takes him up on his offer and goes to Washington, she doesn't just get her foot in the door at HUD. She's offered a job by the cabinet secretary.
I had the privilege of being Secretary Andrew Cuomo's special assistant when he was HUD secretary in the Clinton administration.
Wait, who's that?
This is Alexandra Stanton. She grew up plugged into New York City's political scene before she moved to D.C. She's now the CEO of Empire Global Ventures, a business development firm. But back then, when she worked in politics, she says Cuomo called her after that speech in New York City.
And he said, I'd like you to show a new hire of ours around tomorrow. Her name is Kirsten Rutnick.
Rutnick was Gillibrand's maiden name.
She came, and I remember meeting her in the lobby of HUD the next day.
Stanton clearly recalls her first impression.
Unbelievably smart and competent and efficient. She walked briskly. She's fairly petite, and I'm 5'10", but she stretched out that hand, and it was firm. And I thought, she's a woman's woman.
What does that mean?
I don't know if I knew what it meant back then. I know what I think it means now. I think it's a woman who backs women.
And she shared this story.
Before my first child, Andrea, was born, she had seen me at an event and saw that my stomach was, you know, increasingly protruding and said, I know just the thing.
And not long after, Stanton gets a package in the mail with this high-end snowsuit for the baby and a personal note. Stanton says both her kids wore that snowsuit. She ran into Gillibrand recently.
And I said something like, you know, that amazing snowsuit. She goes, oh, yeah, the plaid one from Patagonia. Yeah, with all the red and the yellows. Oh, it's amazing, right? Do you still have it? Amazing.
Now, Gillibrand has taken that ethos of backing other women and built a whole political action committee around it. She started her Off the Sidelines PAC in 2011, raising $7 million and backing more than 200 women candidates, including 95 in the midterms.
Tonight, I stand before you as this community's first Congresswoman-elect.
Lauren Underwood, a newly elected member of Congress from outside of Chicago, is one of them. On a call with a network of Black women leaders back in March, she described how hard it was to get her campaign off the ground.
To be very candid with you, when I first launched this race, even members of Congress across Illinois, the Black Caucus, other women legislators were intrigued, certainly curious, but were not all in.
Underwood says Gillibrand gave her her first major endorsement through her Off the Sidelines PAC, giving a $10,000 donation and a real shot of legitimacy to the campaign.
It made all the difference that she was willing to step out early and stand with us.
Underwood is a first-time Democratic candidate who managed to flip a seat held by a four-term Republican incumbent. Interestingly enough, that also happens to be exactly what Gillibrand did when she was elected to Congress.
I want to tell you that I am here for two reasons. One is, I do want, more than I can say, to help Kirsten Gillibrand become the next representative from this district.
If Gillibrand was Underwood's big booster, the Clintons gave Gillibrand a major push in her first congressional race in 2006.
Second reason is, I was sent here. This is Hillary's birthday today. I said, what do you want me to do for your birthday? She said, I want you to go to upstate New York and help Kirsten Gillibrand win that election. That's what she said.
And she won that election by a huge margin, jumped into the Senate from there. So she's been super strategic and lucky. But, you know, also this reminds us that she's taken some big risks because, especially around the Me Too movement, she criticized Bill Clinton for his behavior.
Yeah. Gillibrand is one of the political leaders most closely associated with the movement. GQ even labeled her the senator from the state of Me Too.
God.
But don't forget, she was talking about harassment in the military and college campuses 5 years ago. Mm. She's been taking on these issues for a long time. It's part of the reason why she thinks more women need to be in office. She thinks these male-dominated power spheres have ignored harassment, or worse, cultivated it.
Right.
But she's taken heat for her stance on Me Too because the men she's called out are very powerful, and they're Democrats. I asked her about it, Kai.
You have been an outspoken voice since the beginning of the Me Too movement, and you've even taken some flack for it, for Senator Al Franken's resignation, for saying that in retrospect President Clinton should have resigned after what happened with Monica Lewinsky. Is there anything you would have done differently in your activism with the movement?
No, I think this is something that is happening around us, that's real, that you either listen and participate or you choose not to.
And she's not backing down. She sees this as an essential key to understanding who has power and who doesn't.
There are traditional power structures that really do not want to release that grip on power, and they don't want to see the Me Too movement have the lasting impact that it will have. They don't want to see justice being done. They don't want oversight and accountability. They don't want change. They don't want to change the status quo. They like it the way it is.
They like it the way it is. And if we're honest, a lot of us are dangerously comfortable with the status quo. When Gillibrand said Al Franken and Bill Clinton had to go, liberals and Democrats were probably her most harsh critics. The winner-take-all nature of partisan warfare became more important than the larger principle of gender equity. And she was easily the most high-profile person in the party to say, no, it is not. There are more fundamental questions here about who gets to have power and how they get to use it. If we're lucky, that's also the takeaway of the 2018 elections. Millions of people, particularly women, decided they do actually want change, and not just at the margins. And Washington will literally look different as a result. At least 125 women are coming to Congress, a record number. At least 43 of them are women of color, with firsts of all sorts, the first Muslim women, the first Native women, the youngest ever. We're constantly reminded that Trump's presidency is exceptional. Well, this, too, is unprecedented. But the question is, what will become the new normal? We're going to keep pursuing that question. We're going to take a break because, you know, it's been a lot. We've covered a lot of ground in the three seasons of this podcast. So over the coming weeks, we're going to stop and we're going to figure out where we want to go next and how we can best help you make sense of these intense, crazy times. We'll figure it out and we may even ask for your help. More on that soon. But for now, thanks for listening. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios in the newsroom of WNYC. This episode was reported by Bridget Bergen. It was edited by Karen Frillman, who is also our executive producer. Casey Means is our technical director. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Michelle Harris has been our fact checker throughout this season. Allison Light is our intern. Andy Lancet is our archivist. Our team also includes Amanda Aronchik, Christopher Johnson, Jessica Miller, Kari Pitkin, Melinda Siri Wardana, Courtney Stein, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Jim Schachter is Vice President of News for WNYC, and I'm Kai Wright. Talk to you soon. The United States of Anxiety is supported in part by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Additional support for WNYC's election coverage is provided by Emerson Collective, the New York Community Trust, and New York Public Radio trustee, Dr. Mary White.